Hello and welcome to episode 78 of the Creating Happy Writers podcast. It's great that you're here, ready to dive into another episode about writing and publishing nonfiction. My name is Steph Caswell. I'm a multi-published author and a writing coach on a mission to take away the overwhelm, confusion, and frustration from the writing process and give you the confidence and knowledge you need to pursue your writing goals. I'm also dedicated to helping more women write business-boosting books so they can stand out, earn more, and truly become the industry leaders they deserve to be. If you want to find out more about writing and publishing your business or nonfiction book, you can do one or both of these two things. Sign up for my weekly newsletter, The Right Stuff, which is delivered to your inbox every Thursday. It's full of writing and publishing advice. And or you can buy a copy of my book, Dare to Write, which walks you step by step through the writing process to published manuscript. It's available right now on Amazon and on my website. Links to those will be in the show notes. Anyway, let's get started with today's episode, which is the second part of my two special Best of the Guests episodes, where I've pulled together a compilation of great guest advice on a whole variety of topics linked to writing and publishing. A big thanks to all my guests this year. It's been an absolute joy and privilege to interview you. And if you hear something that intrigues you, why not go back and listen to the full episode with that guest? I'll link to their social media, to their books, and the full episodes in the show notes. Let's get cracking. My very first guest today is Shelley Wilson, an author who has written more than 20 books. She brings a refreshingly honest perspective to the realities of book publishing and marketing. In the conversation, we dive into the myths around book sales, the power of genuine community engagement, and how one meaningful connection can spark unexpected success. Listen now as Shelley shares her remarkable journey. I know your first nonfiction book, has sold really well. I'm just going to have to read off my notes here, but it says 20,000 copies, which is, wow, that is not to be sniffed at in the slightest, is it? Crikey.
Absolutely. That snuck up. I did an interview for, I think it was the Writers Forum many years ago. And the lovely, lovely journalist, when we were chatting, he says, how many copies have you sold? And I was like, I don't know. How do I know that? How do I find that data? And he told me, so this is how you sort of go and find bits. This was many years ago. And so I found it. And I remember sending him the message going, oh, my goodness, I've sold, you know, so many. And he was the one that said, you do know that most traditional publishers sell like 5,000 in their lifetime. And I was like, what? And it was, yeah, I think it was that moment where I went, oh, I might be okay at this.
Yeah, just a bit, Shelley, just a bit. Blimey. No, you're right. And I was reading something the other day around the statistics to do with, you know, I think it was an article about how can you sell a million books and should you even try to, or something. That was the sort of the idea around this article. And it was I think it was a guy who'd done some help support for people like Tim Ferriss and stuff like that. And it was really interesting because he was saying that I think it was like people that I think that every year the number of books that sell a million copies is something like 20 out of the 500,000 or whatever plus that are published. 20. And I think we often have this misconception, don't we, that everybody, if you don't sell a million copies, then, you know, you can't really say that you're in any way successful. And actually, the truth is, like you absolutely just said, the majority of people, like majority of traditionally published authors, don't earn out their advances. So they, you know, that sort of thing. And that, you know, it was something like you said, like it's most traditionally published authors would love to sell 5,000 copies. A lot of self-published authors would also love to sell 5,000 copies.
But there's more to it than money as well, isn't there? I think that was what shocked me when he kind of said how many copies, and I was like, I hadn't even thought to look, because it was what it gave me outside of the monetary advance that I got.
I'd love to know sort of what do you think you did that helped towards that in terms of getting people interested in your book and getting those sales? Because obviously it's not about the number per se, but obviously with that level of success, I'd love to know, I'm sure the listeners would love to know, what things were you doing, do you think, that helped towards selling that many?
I think the one thing that I was doing that I still do now and that I'm big on is engagement and communicating. So I actually enjoy social media. I like being out there, but then every now and then I do get a bit of a burnout and I'll disappear into my little black hole. But there is a massive value to having that author platform and being able to be visible. And Twitter was my go-to back in the day. I started that, I think it was back 2013 when I jumped onto Twitter. And I started to engage with a lot of the book bloggers and the other writing community. I made so many amazing friends. And it was through that that my book, me just posting about it, this is what I've done, this is what it's all about. And it was a book blogger, Rosie Amber, who picked it up. And I'd engaged with her a few times and had lots of chats, but she picked it up, she read it, she reviewed it. Fortunately, she loved it. She's one of the top Amazon reviewers. So it just exploded. It absolutely exploded. So I will put hands on heart, it's all down to her, just kind of throwing it up on her platform. And then it kind of went from there, really, as people started to read her blog posts and her reviews, a lot more people started to pick it up. I mean, this was self-published. So my publishers, they re-released it again, but I self-published it in 2014. And I'm still, to this day, getting messages from people telling me what that book has done for them. And just honestly, I've been in tears so many times over the amazing messages people send me. But yeah, it was just putting myself out there, visibility, chatting, engaging, sharing the love of what I do and other people's books as well. I think you'll know this as an author yourself. It's not a competition at all. It's all about collaboration, all of it. And that's the bit I love about being an author and having a relationship with book bloggers as well.
Yeah, I think you're right around the community thing. I think that I always like to say that, and I think actually I said that in Dare to Write, you know, it's got to be about, it's not your competition, it's other people in the community. Because, you know, when you go into a bookshop, you're never going to be the only person who's ever written anything on a particular subject. There's always going to be all of these people who've got certain takes on things, particularly in nonfiction. You know, I'm a massive Habits fan, so I consume all the Habits books. And essentially, I know that fundamentally, the Habits are formed in the same, whoever says it, they're still formed in the same way in my brain. But it's maybe, you know, I always get something new from something, or I just love maybe the style the author's talking it to me, you know, in, that makes it more relatable or makes me remember it in a different way. And I think that's what we have to remember as authors, is actually the likelihood of you know, us writing the exact same book as someone else in the exact same way is just, it's just impossible. That was Shelley Wilson sharing some powerful insights about the importance of authentic engagement in the writing community. Her story reminds us that success isn't just about sales numbers. And it's about building genuine connections and finding your unique voice in a crowded marketplace. Shelley's experience with book blogger Rosie Amber perfectly illustrates how one authentic relationship can create ripples of opportunity. Next, we hear from Emma Hepburn, a clinical psychologist and author who brings a fascinating dual perspective to the writing world. In this short clip, Emma shares her experience with traditional publishing while also balancing her NHS work. And she opens up about a journey that many writers will relate to, accepting the title of author when success comes calling.
I have a huge admiration for people who self-publish, because I think that's, you know, and I can see why beneficial it is, but for somebody who knew nothing about the industry, having that supportive team round about me tell me what would work in publishing, what wouldn't work, but also being really respectful of my content that I was putting in. So if I, you know, very much seeing me as the expert in psychology, but me very much seeing them as the experts in publishing, because I don't know that. And I know a lot more now 4 years down the line, but I knew nothing then. So I have to say I had a really, really positive experience. And for me, I think having those deadlines, having things to work towards, because I was doing it in quite limited time as well, because I still work in the NHS, was hugely beneficial to me. So I can't really comment on the self-publishing side because, but I, for me personally, I'm not sure I could have done that because it would have taken me so much effort to work out how where to go with that. So I can't come to both sides, but I had a very positive experience.
Yeah, no, that's really helpful. Yeah, I think it's difficult because like you say, when you've not had any experience with the publishing world, it's such a new kind of, and it, in some ways it's a very frustrating industry because it's quite slow sometimes and they like to stick to the way they've always done things. And I think that was probably why I was really interested to know how the partnership had felt around, you know, things like illustrations. But I mean, it sounds like that, like you say, perfect timing. In fact, they were actively looking for that kind of content. But I also think that you're right about the team approach. Like you're the expert in what you do and they're the expert in what they do. And it's almost like finding that middle ground as to what feels right for you, the creator, to put into the book, but also for them to know actually, well, what's going to hit the market, what's going to make sense to the people wanting to read it. I think what I wanted to ask you a little bit around, I guess you're obviously so knowledgeable around the psychology part of it, and I thought it'd be remiss of me not to ask you about some of the things that could possibly help writers. I know you talk a bit about imposter syndrome and making mistakes and things like that. Did you find that when you were writing that you felt an element of imposter syndrome? And if you did, or you know, if you can imagine people that do, what sort of things would help get rid of that or help manage it at least?
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, just about everybody feels imposter syndrome. And I think for me, I only just changed my name or my bio on social media and LinkedIn to author this year. So there's something interesting for me that I felt comfortable because I had a qualification, call myself a clinical psychologist, but I never called myself an author. And then my husband said, you've got 3 books, Emma. You need to call yourself an author. So I have. So I've claimed that title. So I think I felt an imposter as an author. And I kind of clung on to, but I've got expertise in psychology. So I guess that probably helped me through it. If I write a nonfiction book ever, who knows what I'll do. I won't have that crutch, I guess. But I think I've noticed myself through the journey, part of it was that kind of fear of making mistakes. And we all have that. So I probably for the first book wrote 2 books. I wrote far too much and I tried because I had no idea kind of how long things would take or what you're expected to send through to the editor. I'd spent ages honing it down, trying to make it perfect. And then I realized that actually you just need to write and just get it down and get something down and it will be imperfect and it will be rubbish and it actually doesn't matter. But also the times that you think you've probably written the most rubbish, you'll go back and look at them and they'll actually be really good because when you're in the middle of it, you just cannot see, you know, if something is really good or not. So there's some things, I mean, I remember sitting in the garden in, I think it was for the second book I wrote and thinking, right, I've got half an hour before the kids come home. I'm just going to blast something out. It doesn't matter what it's like. And I think that was quite freeing, saying, doesn't matter what it's like. Doesn't matter if it's rubbish. And I just blasted something down. And I almost wrote a whole chapter. And it's one of my favourite chapters of the book. But it's because I think I'd taken that pressure off myself and just allowing myself to say, like, just write something. I think we spend so long trying to think about what we'll write and trying to get it right. Well, I certainly did in the first book. By the third book, I was like, I just need to get this down and then I can make it better. But if I've got a blank page, there's nothing for me to make better. I can't make a blank page better in my imagination, but I can make what I've got down on paper better and just getting it done. And I always felt better once I had something on paper. Even if it was cut, you know, later on, it was still there. I'd done it. So I think it's just saying, it's not going to be perfect. And I think we get so caught up in thinking it must be really good. And there's something quite exposing about sending it off to an editor. Now, the first book, I was kind of terrified when I sent it off to the editor the first time. about what I'd get back because I had no idea what they'd be like. So there is something quite exposing about that, which feeds in, I think, to feeling like a, you know, fear of mistakes. But I think you just need to give yourself permission to just accept that you will write something not very good one day. But also, it might actually be much better than you think, and often it will. And actually having something down is better than still thinking about how you're going to put something on the page. So I got better at that as I've gone on. But the first book, I used to sit for ages and construct a chapter and then change it, and I still have a blank page in front of me. So it's been a real learning process.
Yeah, I think you're so right. That was the same for me with my first book. I remember I was trying the whole time to write and edit at the same time. So I'd write a piece and then I'd try and edit it, and I'd be like, no, this, and I'd delete the whole section or whatever and think, no, I got, and it was the most frustrating thing. And I can't remember who I was listening to or, you know, what it was exactly, but it was somebody who basically said, you just need to write.
That was Emma Hepburn giving us a wonderfully honest look at the combination of professional expertise and creative work. I loved that last bit about just writing something down in the first draft. It really resonated for me, and it's something that I really cling to when I'm in first draft mode. Her journey from hesitating to call herself an author despite having three published books to embracing imperfection in the writing process reminds us that even the most qualified among us face similar creative struggles. Emma's story beautifully illustrates how our professional identities and creative lives can intertwine and strengthen each other. Next up is Becky Warrack, who brings a unique dual perspective as both a small publisher and an author. In this excerpt, she shares invaluable insights about marketing books in the digital age, particularly for business authors. Her practical approach to book marketing combines strategic planning with authentic audience connection. There we go again, connection, so important. Listen now as she breaks down what it really takes to get your book into the right hands.
Look, if you want to really go full pelt and throw everything behind it, and if you're a business owner that's written a book and is using it probably to help scale your business, market your business, grow your authority within your business, then you need to put all this effort in, otherwise it's completely pointless. You need to get in front of the right audience, otherwise this book is hiding under a rock.
Exactly. And also there's that element of you have to then keep talking about it and keep talking about it, even when it's published and 3 months down the line, and you still have to have that same excitement for it, you know, 6 months after you've done it. Because if it is the thing that you're using as a tool to bring people into the business, you're going to have to keep talking about it in a way that, you know, keeps engaging new audience people, your new readers that maybe would find it helpful. And I sometimes think maybe when you're an established author, if you're someone who writes, say, for example, fiction and you're 10 books down, like you don't have to talk about like the maybe in the same way. I always think of like authors that I, you know, the traditionally published authors, that they're always talking about their next book or the current book. They're not talking about book one in the series because that's been and gone for them. But for, I think for the people we work with, it may just be you write one book in your life. People sometimes maybe write more, but this is the thing that's going to be helping your business to grow. You've got to keep having that marketing enthusiasm for it as you go 6 months, a year later, or for the lifetime of the book. It might just be that you then end up thinking, actually, I'm not going to talk about it anymore because it's, you know, it's not evergreen. But I don't know. I think I'd love to know then, because you were talking there about a marketing plan, and I love the fact that you had this really helpful system for that author. What were the kind of the things you were including on there that might be helpful for listeners?
The main thing that I really emphasise, well, two main things I really emphasise when I first started working with new clients. First thing is, and I think you touched on it as well, you must know what you want to achieve from publishing your book. It might be you've written your book to be able to become more of an advocate in your niche, and you want to go and get like speaker jobs. There might not be like a monetary goal. It might be, I want to go and get speaker gigs. You might have monetary goals. You might have business scaling goals, but each goal will probably have like slightly more emphasis on different parts of the marketing process. The next part that I really emphasize is you have to nail your target audience. You really have to decipher who you are talking to. And I don't know, maybe you probably touch on this when you're coaching writers how to write their books as well. Like, you need to know who you're writing to, because the language needs to be spot on. If the language isn't talking to the reader, then they're not going to relate. It's not going to have the right vibe for that particular audience. And it's the same with marketing as well. The language has to be spot on. You need to know who you're talking to. You need to know everything about your clients, where they hang out, what they do in their free time, what their kind of routines are. It sounds a bit stalkerish and a bit intense, but you need to know them inside out, because then you'll be able to work out what their kind of buyer routines are and what their kind of predictable search engine routines are. What keywords are they searching for? What categories are they going for in Amazon? So nailing the target audience is one of the first things that I always talk about with my new clients.
I think it's very similar, isn't it? Sometimes when we're doing services for our business, that ideal avatar client thing that we all hate doing, but we know it's essential. But yeah, absolutely, with the ideal reader. And I also think sometimes, for me anyway, I'm writing quite a lot of the time selfishly for myself, because I sometimes feel like I am the age of, and I guess in some weird way, my target audience, in the fact that I'm a business owner and I'm looking to grow and, you know, establish my business even more. But I also think it comes down to some of the anecdotal stuff you put in your tone of voice in your writing. Like, I love talking about popular culture in my writing. So I'll often talk about stuff that only like a 90s and noughties teenager would kind of get, or references to, or stuff about maybe like if my ideal reader is likely to be a parent, you know, I'll make some reference to something to do with parenting. Or, and I think it comes down to, yes, knowing them from the kind of marketing side, but I think also when it comes to writing and your tone of voice and trying to engage with them and connect with them, when you can make little references about stuff that they get and find entertaining or funny, or even just relatable, it's just so much more powerful as a book, because then they actually feel like they know you and you know them. And that's the beauty of good writing.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, my book's like that as well. So my book, while it's aimed very specifically, like, I've niched down massively and aimed my book, and it's called Self-Published Like a Pro, and it's aimed towards entrepreneurs who want to self-publish their book. But whilst the language in the book is very like tailored to business owners who already run their own business, and they have, they all do typical things that a business owner would do, because I've done my ICA and I've worked out who they are. But at the same time, if you're a fiction writer, you can go, and the process of self-publishing is the same, basically. But yeah, the language that I've used in my book is very directed towards a specific audience. So hopefully that it will resonate with that audience more than anyone else.
That was the wonderful Becky Warrack sharing her expert knowledge on targeted book marketing. Her emphasis on knowing your specific audience and maintaining consistent marketing momentum long after publication offers a realistic roadmap for authors. I particularly loved how she and I explored that counterintuitive truth about niching down, that sometimes the more specific your focus, the more powerful your book's impact can be. As she puts it, it's not about reaching everyone, but about reaching the right readers deeply. Hear, hear. Next guest on this compilation episode is a very special person to me. It's Jessica Brown, a professional editor who brings a warm and collaborative approach to the editing process. I should know this because she's my editor, and so I was delighted to talk to her. In our short clip here, she demystifies what really happens when an author sends their manuscript to an editor. And if you've ever felt nervous about sharing your work with an editor, as I was right at the beginning of my journey, or maybe you're wondering what actually happens during the editing process, you'll want to hear Jess's perspective. I can remember the first book I wrote and the nerves I felt sending it off to somebody, because chances are, unless you have had a developmental editor, the chances are that the first person or maybe the second person to ever read your manuscript is going to be your editor. And I think there's a real piece of work to be done around trying to reassure people that an editor, or a good editor at least, will have your best interests at heart. What do you find is the most common, I don't know, concern people have or worry that authors have when they get in touch with you? What do they sort of often worry about sending their work to you?
Yeah, I think if people have never worked with an editor, they're quite unsure as to what to expect. I think some people are quite concerned that they're just going to red pen the whole lot and completely change everything, which, you know, any professional editor shouldn't be taking that approach. And I feel it's really important to make it a very collaborative process. At least that's how I work, so that, you know, all my clients know that I will give them suggestions, but ultimately they know their voice better than anybody else. And so, you know, it's very much a collaborative process between the editor and the author. And if, you know, there's a suggestion that they feel, well, I wouldn't actually say it like that, then that's absolutely fine. A lot of the time, the editor's job is to play devil's advocate, just to ask the questions, just to make sure, like, did you mean this? And to offer suggestions and alternatives. But it's nothing is set in stone, because ultimately it's your book. And as the author, and that is the beauty of self-publishing, is you get to have full creative control. So whereas when you work with a publishing house who have essentially bought the rights to your book, they have a lot more agency to make changes over the author. Whereas when you're self-publishing, you have complete control. So you shouldn't be railroaded into making any decisions that you don't feel fully aligned with.
And I think that's really important. Some people assume that when an editor looks at their work, that they're going to make changes that they would maybe don't want them to make, or that they're worried that it's going to get changed without them knowing. And I think it's really important, isn't it, for people to understand that even if you're with a traditional publishing house, no one would change anything without at least having a conversation with you if we're at traditional publishing level. But if you're at self-publishing level, an editor that is, you know, doing the job properly will, like you say, only ask the questions or make suggestions. And, you know, when I do structural editing reports, you know, the developmental editing reports that I do, I always say to people, these are just suggestions. You don't have to take on any of them if you don't want to. But, you know, in order to make it a better experience for the reader, because ultimately they are the most important person at the end of it, as much as we want us to think that as writers we're the most important person because we've got all the knowledge, the reader is the most important person. So having that pair of eyes that can act as the reader, because we write, and when we read back our work, we're reading it back as writers, we're not reading it back as readers. And so having somebody's expert eyes on it, but also, you know, playing the role of the reader and saying, actually, I'm reading this for the first time, I'm not quite sure what you mean here, or could you explain this a bit more? Or maybe you've, as in my case with one of the chapters in Dare to Write, I think it was the habits one, I waffled on for too long about habits and you very kindly pointed that out. And I think as I was writing it, I was like, you know what, I think I'm waffling a bit more in this chapter than I have in any others. But you know, when it's the first draft, second draft, you sort of leave it in, and then it's coming back to it and having another look at it once your editor's given it sort of an eye and given you their feedback. So I think it's so important to reassure people that an editor who is you know, great at their job is there to, like you say, play the devil's advocate, but actually do it in a way that is supportive. And it's constructive feedback, isn't it? It's not criticism, it's constructive feedback that is going to make the book better.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is just that objective pair of eyes, but also I think from the editor's perspective, being mindful that this is a big deal for most authors. This is, most of them I work with are first time authors, and it's a huge deal, and to be sensitive about that, and yeah, and taking that process at whatever pace they are happy with, and keeping those communication lines open so they know that I am on their side, and try to make that as positive as possible, because that's, you know, I think that publishing your first book should be an amazing experience. So that is something that I'm very mindful of, and I feel very privileged that people have given me their manuscripts, and it's not something that I consider lightly.
That was Jessica Brown sharing her invaluable insights into the editing process. Her emphasis on editing as a collaborative journey rather than a red pen takeover offers a refreshing perspective for authors. As she points out, a good editor serves as both an advocate and ally, helping authors enhance their work while preserving their unique voice. Her reminder that constructive feedback isn't criticism, but rather a path to making the book better for readers, is something we should all endeavour to remember during the editing process. Guest number 5 is from episode 68. It's the wonderful Nia Thomas, who faced a fascinating challenge. How do you transform a PhD thesis into an engaging business book? In this short extract, Nia shares her journey of bridging the gap between academic research and practical business wisdom, while using podcasting as a way to keep her message alive. Her story is a brilliant one in how different forms of content can shape and refine your core message. You mentioned that you have a podcast and obviously you have a thesis from your PhD. How did those things help you as well when it came to what you wanted to put in the book and what you decided to leave out?
Well, these were the things I probably struggled with most, which is one of the reasons that you and I worked together, because I had my thesis, but I knew that the academic tone of it really wasn't going to be what people wanted in a business book. And I really didn't know how to take it from academia to the office. And I'd been thinking for a long time, what do I add to a book? What bits do I take out? So for a long while, I did nothing. I tinkered around with it. And then for about a year, I didn't do anything. And in that time, I thought, I really need to keep the conversation about self-awareness alive. How am I going to do that? Podcasting is a new medium. Haven't got a clue how to do it, but I'll do that. So I had a thesis. I had lots of conversations from podcast guests. And it was about, how do I use these two things to really get me to a place where I can give people a business book that is useful, that does give them tips, tools, techniques and a guide. So it was quite a test for me as to how I took that academic stuff, added the conversational stuff from the podcast, bring it all together, meld it into something that would be useful to people. So for me, without your help as a book coach, I'm not sure I'd have got the right tone. So for me, it was really important that I did have somebody who could look at it from a different perspective and suggest, well, what about this and how do you add that? But don't do too much of this and don't do too much of that. Make sure that you've got the balance of that academic and that research and that conversation. So for me, it was a really brilliant process to go through to work out how you put all these jigsaw pieces together so that you've got a book that is live, it's got research, it's got findings, it's robust, but it also has live commentary from people who are walking the walk into it, so that it really gives it those examples of what it looks like, sounds like and feels like when you're living it.
I've been thinking recently about how I feel books, and this has come through my experience of working with people like you, how books can really help us refine our messaging and really think about what are the nuts and bolts of what I want to be known for, what I want to have an opinion about, what are the most essential things I need to impart to the reader. And through my own experience of writing, but I know through the clients I talk to, from other people I talk to who've written books, it's this really interesting process, isn't it, where you're forced to pick out the very best of a vast amount of knowledge that you may have on a particular topic to make it relevant. But it's actually super helpful. Did you find that you've really refined now exactly what your message is and what you want to be talking about on the regular? Is that something you found?
Oh, definitely. Yes. Because I remember people asking me about what is self-awareness, and I'm thinking, oh well, it's a 2,000 word chapter, how long have you got? I'll explain all of that to you. But now when people ask me what it is, I will say it's reflection, recognition, regulation. And I only did that through a process of having to start with the very big chapters, refining it again to a point where actually, this can form now a heading within the book. Interestingly, as you were saying that, I was thinking one of the most interesting things that I happened was that somebody was posing a question on Twitter, and they said, "What is your podcast about?" And I thought, I don't know, and I've got to do this in about whatever it is, the 240 characters. And it came to be discussing self-awareness with thinkers from around the globe. And that's exactly what happened with the book. It was those, you have to work out what your framework is. And to do that, you have to work out what your headings and your subheadings are. And you can only do that when you synthesize and you simplify your 2000 word chapter from your thesis into something that makes sense to somebody. So most definitely, without having gone through this exercise, both through the podcast and the branding and the book, I think all of those elements help you get to a point of what are you actually trying to say? And if you can say it in 5 words, that for me means that you're in a position then to talk to people about the wider definition.
That was Nia Thomas sharing her powerful insights about the process of distilling complex ideas into clear, actionable content. If you are someone with a PhD thesis, Nia's journey should be something you can go back and listen to, because it's fascinating to hear how she took something that was academic and complex and turned it into her brilliant book. I do also think that the fact that she could take a 2000 word academic chapter and turn it into something that can explain self-awareness in just 3 words, reflection, recognition, regulation, demonstrates how a book can really help to clarify your message. And this is something during 2024 that's really hit home for me as an author, but also as a book coach. So as she puts it, it's about getting to the point where you can say something meaningful in just 5 words while still having the depth to then explain more should people ask you. My final guest in this special compilation episode is Hilary Saltzman, whose conversation about women's storytelling struck such a chord with you all that it became one of my most popular episodes. In this powerful excerpt, Hilary dives deep into why many women hesitate to share their stories, exploring everything from childhood conditioning to present-day social pressures. Her insights about the complex dynamics of women's voices in public spaces are both challenging, but so bloody inspiring. What do you think it is about us as women that stop us telling our stories? Now, you mentioned vulnerability, and I would say that's obviously a massive part, but you work with a lot of people on this. What is it about sharing our story that you think as women particularly we struggle with?
How long have you got? I mean, yeah, I'm not a psychologist, but I think there is so much that is deep-rooted fears, deep-rooted narratives. You know, I remember when someone explained to me in the form of like a tape that you replay in your head over and over again. And often those are tapes that got recorded in your early childhood. and those tapes stick with you for a long time. And I think, you know, if I look at my upbringing, which was very lovely, you know, privileged middle class, you know, upbringing. But I was brought up around things like, you know, girls shouldn't be bossy. Girls shouldn't be emotional. You know, we've got to know our place. You know, all of those things that we're told through family, at school, you know, it's programmed in us to be a little bit more kind of meek and you know, and not really promote ourselves and put ourselves out there. It's not the thing to do when you're a young girl. And that doesn't go away anywhere as you get older. It almost gets worse. And it's wherever we look, we're kind of, women are criticized when they've got opinions, when they've got voices, they're too private, and then they share, and then they share too much, and it you know, or they're being manipulative because they told the story, and are we supposed to care? And it's everywhere. And you know, I growing up, going into I had a career in corporate marketing. That's where my kind of background came from. And even then, in leadership roles, you had a female leader that stood up and had, you know, a really strong opinion about something, they were criticized for it. And then a man could stand up and say exactly the same thing and everyone's cheering. They're like, oh, you're amazing. And I just, yeah, it's just, it's a really hard place to be. And nowadays, social media, it's women see other women all the time standing up, speaking out, telling their story and being ripped apart for it. And it's hard. So you kind of, you know, people are working through these issues. And a lot of my clients are like, well, I really, really want to tell my story. I know that I can face up to these fears. I know, you know, my past doesn't need to impact me anymore. But then they see it happening now. And it's like that scares them. And a lot of it is from other women as well. And I think it's like we're getting it on all sides. Women can be really, really nasty to other women. I remember speaking to someone a couple of years ago in a networking group, and I was talking, we just got talking, funnily enough, about her story. And she had a really interesting background that had led her to do what she did. And I was like, yeah, I think your clients would really value, you know, there'd be great value in hearing you talk about this. And she said, oh, I don't know. What if I put something out there and one of the school mums reads it? I mean, that's, you know, I can identify with that feeling, absolutely. Isn't that awful that, you know, and I said, well, would they ever buy from you? No, they're not my customer. Well, why does it matter? But we go there, don't we? We go to that place, oh, what if this person reads it? And what would they think? And what if they judge me? And what if they don't like me? Or it's, yeah, I wish I knew the answers. I wish I was there is, but it comes from so many different factors. And I think it's why books like this, the work I'm doing, you know, people that I work with, it feels so important to me that we've got to start championing women more. We've got to be finding ways to live amongst the negative chatter, amongst our fears, and kind of come together and push through them and do this, because we've got to change this narrative around women not being allowed, you know, not taking up space, not deserved of taking up space. And no one else is going to change that narrative for us. Men aren't going to. It's just not going to happen. So it's kind of up to us to do it. And I really think that starts by just, yeah, more people doing it. You know, the more we can do it, the more it's going to help us, the more it's going to make us feel part of something that doesn't feel quite so scary, and the more it's going to help next generation.
Oh, my favourite part of that conversation. Hilary shared some great stuff about the barriers we face as women when we're trying to tell our stories. Her observation that change needs to come from within the community of women supporting each other rather than waiting for external validation is so powerful. As she points out, seeing more women step forward to tell their stories creates the safety and the inspiration for others to do the same. It's a great reminder that every woman who shares her story helps pave the way for others to find their voices. And that is a wrap on part two of this special compilation episode. What struck me about these conversations is how many different sides there are to the publishing journey. From Shelley's insights about authentic community engagement, to Emma's candid reflections on claiming her identity as an author, to Becky's strategic approach to finding your perfect readers. We heard Jessica demystify the editing process with such warmth and clarity, because that is who Jess is, while Nia showed us how to transform complex ideas into accessible wisdom. And finally, Hilary's powerful, powerful reminder about the importance of women claiming their right to tell their stories. What connects all these conversations is a deep understanding that successful writing isn't just about the words on the page. It's about knowing your worth, finding your people, and having the courage to share your unique perspective with the world. I hope these insights give you the confidence to take your next step, whether that's working with an editor, refining your message, or finally sharing that story you've been holding on to. Remember, every author you've heard today started exactly where you are now, wondering if they could do it. And as their journeys show, yes, you absolutely can. Don't forget, if you'd like to hear the full interviews with any of these wonderful women, you can find them in my back catalogue, which I'll link to in the show notes. And if you know another writer who'd enjoy these episodes, do share the podcast with them too. Until next time though, happy writing.